Welcome to the Pet Professional Guild Advocacy Task Force panel for May 2024. I'm Don Hansen. I'm the co-chair of the task force and the Shock Free Coalition, and I am also your moderator today. So our published topic was, how do we build relationships with clients? And the panel knows before, sometimes I tweak this at the last moment, and I at least gave you a couple days notice on this. But I really want us to think of it as about how do we turn prospects into clients? Because people come to see us as pet care professionals for many reasons. Number one on my list is they've worked with us in the past and want to work with us again. I've got a couple who I've helped with many dogs. They've moved away, but they heard I did an online puppy class. So where did they come to start with their new pup? They came to me, which made me feel great. Number two, someone has been referred to us by someone who has worked with us or another pet care professional who knows us and trusts us, and that enough is to get people across the line. But in most cases, these two categories have already decided they want to work with us. Those are the easy ones. We already have a relationship and might even say we have a partnership with them and their pet. And the folks I just talked to you about, we've had a lifelong partnership with them through many, many pets. Like most relationships, we trust one another. In other words, we've established the same connection with our clients we're trying to get them to create with their pets. However, other pet prospects have a pet and suddenly, often in a panic, contact us desperate for help. It might be on Facebook, via email, or via a call, if we're lucky, or maybe we're lucky when they don't call. And they're solely looking for an immediate solution to what they perceive as a serious problem. Typical first questions are, how much will it cost? How close are you to where I live? And how long will I take before they ask anything else? Our credentials, our philosophy, and methods are the last thing on their minds. When we get a call like that, where do you guys start? And don't make me pick, you know how this works. I'm looking for someone to volunteer to start off. Where do you start with those folks? Judy, thank you.
Honestly, most people don't know to even ask or think about credentials or methods. They just want their dog to have, or they want the help they can have for their dogs. So I rarely get the question of how much does it cost. I'm seeing less and less of that. But when they ask that, I say, I'm happy to talk to you about price, but let me tell you what you should be asking when you call trainers. I may not be the person you select. So when you call the next person, here's what I suggest you ask them. And I explain to them methods and credentials, and then we just go from there. You know, the conversation's going to lead where it leads, but I explain to them what they should be looking for in a trainer. And then we'll go on and talk, and if they select me, great. And if they choose to check out some other people first, at least they're asking the right questions.
Okay.
So that's how I go.
How about others of you?
So I can talk about what I did.
Sure.
I don't take phone calls anymore. And that's really a time management strategy. But what I do is my outgoing voicemail directed people to the website and to my email. And then the website is essentially a pre-screening tool that explains what I do. It's not up anymore because I'm not currently working with clients, but it had pricing on there. It had methods on there. It had all kinds of detailed information so that by the time people got to me, they already basically wanted to work with me. And once I implemented that, it was very scary to put everything up there. It's like, people won't contact me if they see what my prices are. But that's not what happened at all. And I got to the point where almost 100% of the people that contacted me followed through with training, which was great because then I was only getting the people who really wanted to work with me. And it wasn't that way before. Like, I'm not saying like, I'm so great that everyone wants to work with me. It's just that I was sending them to the information ahead of time that allowed them to make that decision. And then if they didn't want to work with me, they just didn't contact me.
You know, it's interesting. I've been doing the same thing for a number of years as well. I do it a little bit differently, but for time management, I just avoided phone calls because oftentimes those phone calls can be 45 minutes with 10 minutes of the information you really need to extract. And I started asking them to contact me via email. And then I send them a link to the website, some articles to read. And when people go through that step, generally, if they decide to go contact me again, I know that they're a client and it just makes it a lot easier. Beth, you had your hand up previously. What do you do?
Yeah, and I think Allison knows this too, that a lot of times when you're working with cats, people contact you because a friend or their veterinarian suggested that they contact you, but they're skeptical that behavior work can be done with cats. So the first thing that they really want is to be convinced that behavior work can be done with cats. And I agree with you, Dawn, that a lot of times I prefer to start that with email, but sometimes people do call me and I'll speak to them for about 10 minutes. I typically ask them what the problem is and tell them what kinds of work can be done and what kind of success I've had working with clients who've had those kinds of problems. So I just kind of outline that, yes, that's a typical behavior problem, and there are very specific behavior steps that we can take to deal with it. So this is not some amorphous cat communication, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't kind of thing. So I'm very specific, and I talk to them. I also always emphasize that I work from a scientific basis, from a basis of behavior science, so that because the real task is convincing them that anything at all can be done. They're typically very skeptical.
Who would agree that I think even with dogs, people are often very skeptical when it comes to behavior stuff, not training stuff, but I'm going to pick on Dan and Sam and Sandy for some input there. And I'll get back to you, Allison.
Yeah, I've had interesting conversation with a friend of mine that was a coworker for 25 years, and his new dog was hit by a car and then recovered physically, but was fearful of cars that resembled the one that hit him. So primarily I was working on some training, but I also had to address the fear. And he asked me quite seriously if dogs could remember or could learn. And I thought that was really interesting because he himself had been a trainer of human beings. And it didn't seem to occur to him that dogs have a memory, which I thought was kind of revealing. But turned out to be a really good client, and we made great progress with the dog, and the dog remembered things very well.
Sandy, you were anxious to hop in on this.
I usually, because I work with bites and fights and large dogs, I usually get referrals from behaviorists and from vets and from rescues. So it's very rare that I get a client from nowhere, you know, from the website. And so I'm already in damage control because either my case is either they had a trainer before that did horrific things or they're leaning towards that. So I do talk to them on the phone, and I talk to every single client on the phone. And if by the end of the speech, if by the end of my spiel, you know, they don't hire me, I say to them, if you don't hire me, you're not going to break my bank, but please send me the trainer that you are going to hire, because you're not going to break my bank, but you're going to break my heart if you hire somebody that is going to hurt your dog. And many times the person that calls me, they are broken, you know, either there was a horrible bite and all that stuff. So I speak with them like I would have liked somebody to speak with me when I first got Maya. You know, so it's very important for me to talk on the phone and to kind of steer them away from the shock callers, or to have them forgive themselves for having used this in the past.
Allison, you wanted to add something after Beth had spoke.
Yeah, I will say the same as Beth of that a large part of what I found when I started out was I had to convince people that I could even help them. I work with cats, so that's the one thing, convincing them that cats can be helped. And the other thing is I'm in the Midwest, and I think the Midwest is probably further behind than other areas as far as people believing that cats can be helped. So when I started, I used to actually do a free meet and greet virtual. That way they could kind of ask me some questions, get to know me, understand what I can help them with. I don't do that anymore. I've been doing the business for a while, but instead I ask them for a deposit for that meet and greet. So it's not free, but I still do the meet and greet. So they have a chance to get to know, I'm not just this random stranger they're giving money to. I have started recently doing, just like some of you, I do on my, like my Facebook page, and my messages now say, go to my website, fill out my form. But I still have people who will contact me through email, or they'll still call me, and then I'll respond either through email or text, and I will kind of ask some questions of, like, to find out what their what the big problem is. I find out if they can afford me, because that's a big thing too. And if I can't, I will give them, like, here's some free resources or a different solution. And then I try to kind of find a common ground of, like, or I kind of say, like, here's some, I've helped clients with this. Yes, your cat can be helped. Just like Beth said, you know, what's the science behind it? What's the things that we can do to help the cats? And if they get to the point where they decide they're going to do the meet and greet with me, I start out by giving them, here's all the great things that are happening. Because I think, Sandra, you said of, I might be wrong, but I think, Sandra, you said of, like, that there's a lot of stress that they're going to have. So I start out with, here's all the positive things that are going on. Yes, and you came to me because you were, like, there's so much stress. So let's start with all the things you remember of, here's the good things, and now here's how I can help you. So I'm only a few years into the business, so it's still kind of evolving how I do it. But I think I'll learn from all of you, but that's also some things I've been learning.
So I'm going to take us down a bunny trail here, and it might be straight off the pier into the lake. But I think it's worth talking about. And we've had a couple of folks that have suggested that, you know, first of all, we have to convince people that this will work with animals. How many of you still find vets need to be convinced? Debbie, talk to us.
Hi, guys. Sorry I was late. Early on, I spoke to quite a few vets and did convince them. And they would have a long list of people that they would recommend for issues. And we went over, you know, all the different modern day happenings. And two of the veterinarian practices in my area, you know, got rid of that list. And now they're always calling me and I'm doing presentations for them, you know, once a year, sometimes every 6 months. One of the veterinarians that I work closely with was at a meeting last month, and she gave my name to other veterinarians in the next town over. So I think it's so important not to be afraid to go in and talk to the veterinarians, you know, and tell them what's going on. And I think you find usually that they appreciate hearing from you, because, you know, don't forget, a lot of veterinarians, you know, didn't take the behavior classes. And they, I find that they really want to know and appreciate it.
Eddie, from an academic standard, you know, how do we convince professionals or just people with pets? What are your thoughts?
I mean, my thoughts are possibly not all there, given that it's the middle of the night for me. So I just set an alarm to show up here for this. But
well, thank you for that. We appreciate that.
No problem. And there's not a lot that I would say in this area either, because, you know, I am an academic. I'm not somebody who is going out and hiring my services to help guardians or owners with their pets directly. So there's not much I can say to that, but I will say, just with respect to veterinarians and convincing veterinarians, talking to veterinarians, there is a big shift that's happening. And given that I'm in the middle of I'm in a school of animal and veterinary sciences, and I work with a lot of vet students, and I'm going and presenting in July to the Australia and New Zealand College of Veterinary Science, their Science Week. It's really, I'm quite optimistic about where the direction of what vets are learning now, or what they're willing to learn. I think that's the important thing, not so much necessarily what they're learning. They're certainly not necessarily learning it through their courses, because what is typically those 3 years of most DVM programs is still very much focused on the what they would typically learn. I don't think that's changed that much. It's just the mindset of what they're learning. They're not necessarily getting behavior courses in those, or even hearing behavior lectures during that coursework, because there's just not a lot of movement through most vet programs to adjust what all the information they need to learn. But the mindset, I think, is what's been changing. We see a lot there. So I think that's promising, very promising. So that's the little bit that I could offer there. In terms of the science and what we can do to show some of that, I mean, I think there's just a lot more information available. And for those clients that are interested, I think there are resources that people can show them. I always like to talk about, I like to mention Zazie Todd's website that shows quite a number of the publications that are out there, or mentions a lot of the references, I should say, not necessarily to the publications. And it's also becoming a lot more likely. For instance, most of my publications these days are open access, so anyone can download those. And just to give you an example, we just published one in Applied Animal Behavior Science on the effects of choice on welfare. And something that we spend so much time talking about, which is the importance of choice and control. Now, here's the shocking part. We just did a scoping review, not one experimental study in a companion animal setting on the effects of choice on companion animal welfare. So we do, there's need to be cautious about what we are saying in some of these conditions with respect to the science. But it's also, I'm optimistic, it's promising, it's showing how much more access people have to good information. So, and I would, with respect to that publication, we need to have more science, specifically with respect to that. I have no doubt that choice and control is important for companion animals. And that's why I thought it was at least a little disappointing that there are no experimental studies examining the effects of choice for companion animal welfare.
I mean, I would agree with you. That is disappointing. On the other hand, I do think it is very, very exciting to see that more and more of these studies are open access. I mean, I remember a time when if you wanted to download the full study, it was going to cost you between $30 and $40. Fortunately, I have a friend at a major university who, anytime I wanted something, they could get it for me for free. But yeah, Christina, you've got your hand up. Thank you.
Yeah, I can speak a little bit to some of the research on what's going on with dog guardians. I think most of the research that is out there is currently on dog guardians. But there's been kind of a slew of papers that has come out lately looking at this topic. And There's several things that come across pretty strongly. I'll try to summarize it briefly because it's hard. So one is that people are often not understanding still the link between behavior and emotion in their dogs. And they are, and I'm saying dogs, not that it wouldn't apply to other species, but because that's the research that we have is on dogs. And so they're often misattributing the cause. So they might say, well, I think my dog is behaving like this because they've been spoiled, for example, when that probably has nothing at all to do with it in most cases. And so that's one thing is there's still this lack of understanding of that impact of the underlying emotion. And I mean, I'm just trying to decide sort of what to focus on because I could actually go on quite a bit. There's a study that came out that I actually think we talked about briefly at the last advocacy group on client-centered care. And they found that there were four themes that were really important for getting important to clients when working with a professional. And so one of them was that they had obviously a positive opinion of the professional and their effectiveness, but they also valued things like empathy, not being judged, feeling heard, and then getting practical support and follow-up, and then helping them understand why the behavior was happening was something that they were really interested in as well, in addition to a plan that they felt like was tailored to them and was flexible and could be implemented incrementally instead of a whole bunch of information all at once. And another thing that I thought was really interesting that they found is that responses to the statement, my views of dog behavior were challenged, was neutral. So it didn't contribute to people having more positive or more negative views of their trainer. And I think, I mean, I don't know. I know for me, sometimes I was worried about telling a client something they didn't want to hear because I thought that would make them feel uncomfortable or challenged or they wouldn't want to listen to me. But actually that doesn't necessarily seem to be really important.
Okay. Good information. I'm going to use something you said there to take us along another path that I think is important here. When you do get one of those clients who says something like, well, he's doing this because he's spoiled, or, you know, there's so many other things we could say instead of spoiled. How do each of you address that and convince your clients that, no, there's something else at work here? Beth, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, we hear this a lot in cats. So strangely enough, Cesar Millan has affected cats as well. I can't tell you how many people have told me my cat is being dominant with me. I really have learned not to laugh when people say that. It was a learning curve for me not to laugh, but I always say, you know what? I think your cat knows that you weigh 100 pounds more than him. But we do get a lot of my cat's being spiteful, my cat is angry, my cat is jealous. And I start by saying, I can certainly understand how it would seem that way to you. I understand how it feels that way. So I try not to negate it instantly. I try to first show them that I hear what they have to say. Because they're saying that because there is this brokenness, this Sandra that you described very clearly, there is this brokenness and this sadness. Somehow my cat doesn't love me anymore. I don't love my cat anymore. So I try to just start by saying, I hear you. I understand why you think it feels like if your cat's peeing on your pillow that they're being angry and spiteful. I understand how that feels that way. That's kind of an angry, crazy thing to say if a human did it. You know, if I came to your house and peed somewhere other than the bathroom, that would be kind of an angry, crazy, aggressive thing to do. You know, so I kind of let them know that they've been heard. And then the next thing is, but we've actually done a lot of research about this in cats, and here's what we know now about why cats do this. So then I go to the science. So I start with the emotional. I hear you. I understand you. And then I go to the science.
How do others handle that type of question? Or Debbie put up the stubborn word. My dog's just being stubborn. You know, that's another common one we hear. How do you address that, Judy? Then Deb.
Let me unmute. When somebody tells me their dog is stubborn, I will tell them, wow, you are so lucky. And they'll look at me like, what are you talking about? And I'll say, stubborn dogs are generally, first of all, you know, I don't encourage them to use that term, but I said, that's generally a dog that's extremely intelligent. So you're going to have to work a little bit harder to get up to the level where he can understand and you can use the behaviors that you don't like to your advantage. And spoiled, I tell him what my mom said. She was a preschool teacher. The saddest thing in the world is a child that's not spoiled. And when I say spoiled in that term, I don't mean that, you know, you're painting your dog's toenails. I mean loved. So reverse the word, take the word spoiled out and turn it into love. And they kind of wake up and go, okay. But stubborn, I just kind of focus it on your dog's really smart. And he thinks some of the things you're asking him to do are probably ridiculous. And just kind of make a game of it, depending on the person you're talking to, because there's no standard answer, because you don't know how that person's going to handle it. You have to kind of learn how to talk to those individuals.
Well, I think that's a good point. We'll get to you next, mm-hmm. Debbie, but I'm glad you brought that up too, because just like every dog is an individual, so is every person. And that's why, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody says you, they're going to send you the cookbook way to handle all of these situations.
There is none.
There is none. And, you know, what do they determine by all? Because you've really, it depends on the person, their personality, their life circumstance, other factors in the household. I mean, it gets really complex very, very quickly. Debbie, what were you going to add?
I was going to agree with Beth. And now, of course, I agree with Judy as well. We're all in agreement. I think people get so stuck on their words, or they hear them from their friends. Look at your dog is so stubborn. Look at your cat, your stubborn cat, my goodness. And it's so, or you know, I hear all the time, I ask my dog to come and he doesn't come. And I ask him and I ask him and I ask him. And then I always go to, like, you know, do you say to your husband, you know, hang up your coat, Fred, 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 hang up your coat. You know, why don't, are you asking and kind of giving a chance to process, or are you doing one of these things? And I don't know why I got off onto that, but I did. But anyways, you know, as far as the dog being large and in charge, you know, I always remind people that, yeah, sometimes it seems that way, but sometimes we want them to feel like they're in charge, just like sometimes we want to feel like we're in charge. And really, we're the only ones that can open the door or get a cookie. And if we want a cookie, we can get a cookie anytime. So, you know, these are things to keep in mind.
Sam, we haven't heard much from you. Any thoughts on all of this?
Most of the time I'm in a situation that Sandra is in, where it's vet behaviors, veterinarians, or other professionals reaching out to me. But when I get that call from someone who is just, they're upset, right? They're confused. They're scared. They don't know what to do. And so basically I get them to talk about it. You know, someone says to me, you know, my dog's being this way, and whatever words they're using, tell me what that looks like, you know? And when they're doing that, and then we take it a little further, and I find that most people, going back to my prior career, you know, most people like to talk about themselves or about their situation, problem, challenge, whatever it might be that's going on. And if you would take the time to ask the right questions at the right time, you get more information, but also they begin to see that you empathize with what's happening, and it starts to give them some hope. And then they start asking you questions. Well, now that you explain, now I'm saying that, what do you think? And then I'll, you know, jump in with a couple words here and there, whatever. And we start to become, we develop this rapport where they're starting to believe that their dog isn't the second coming of, you know, Cujo and Jaws and everything else all run into one. And the fact that there is hope, there is help, that there are problems that we can always make positive change with. We never know how much, but now all of a sudden they're willing to give it a shot. You know, they're not as desperate. Because let's face it, most of the time, especially with more severe problems, dogs, cats, horses, whatever it may be, people are scared.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they're scared that somehow they're not going to be able to help or fix this companion animal that they love and cherish so much. And so we got to remember that and give them not false hope, but let them know that there are things we can do that can reduce, mitigate, whatever the circumstances. And we have to do it in a way that they understand, which is why I'm so big anymore into getting rid of the jargon that we use a lot and whatever else, because it confuses the hell out of people, let's face it. And that's also why they don't care that much about credentials, whatever else. They want to know, how can you help? And so you've got to be able to give them some concrete information, but it's got to be done so that you're not preaching to them. You know, you're having a conversation and at a level that they can understand.
I think the teaching instead of preaching and the avoiding the jargon are key, because I think we confuse ourselves with the jargon, because there are so many different professions that operate in this sphere and we all use different jargon. We're going to be talking about that at a panel in August, if I remember my dates right, which Pam, pop me in the chat what comes next month. So when I wrap up, I know what to say. Thank you. So what's, Allison, go ahead.
I just wanted to add to what Sam said, because so besides doing client work, I also do post-adoption support calls for our shelter. And one of the things that I've really learned from that is exactly like Sam said, of people just want to have someone who's going to talk about, that they can talk to about their problem and find out there's a solution. And I mean, obviously we don't want to spend 45 minutes doing that, but if we can do that in a concise way and still make them feel like they're being heard, they're being listened to, different of my clients will say like, well, you're almost like a counselor. I mean, if they feel like they have someone walking along the side with them, that's going to give them help and solutions, be there to support them, I think that goes so much for them wanting to work with us. It's probably hard when you're trying to get someone in to sell them on your service. When I'm doing post-adoption support, I'm not trying to sell anybody, so just have that time. But it is something that I kind of translate over to working with, you know, trying to get clients. If it's just, people just want to know that you're right, they're desperate. They just want to know there's help and someone who will be there for them.
Dan.
I like what Allison said. It reminds me of a family that contacted me recently. They've got a 110-pound German Shepherd that is terrified of everybody outside the family and has been fearful since an 8-week-old puppy. And another sibling in that puppy's family has the same behavior. So they went to a trainer that essentially did flooding. So the trainer's advice was to have people come into your home, put your dog on leash, and just let them bark it out. And they did this repeatedly at the cost of several thousand dollars. And ultimately, they declared that the trainer had made things worse, that their dog hated the trainer, and would go into a 45-minute barking frenzy until somebody finally left. So they were pretty desperate. They had spent a lot of money, had done a lot of training class, and they had a dog that was really, had to be muzzled all the time, was a bit of an escape risk. They lived in a neighborhood where the neighbors didn't like them anymore because of the dog. And when I met their dog, I was very honest with them. The dog was barking, lunging, broke out of his muzzle. Said, you know, the dog's emotional state is such that I can't work with him, but I can refer you to someone that would have better qualifications. So I referred him to John Sirabassi, a veterinary behaviorist in Chicago. And they were very happy that I gave them an honest assessment and that I gave them some hope. There's actually two veterinary behaviorists at that veterinary practice in Chicago. So I talked a bit about how I'd met John Sirabassi and what I thought about his expertise and experience, and they were very hopeful. So it gave them something other than disaster to think about. And they were willing to make the trip to Chicago to see someone who I think is far better qualified than anyone in our local area.
Well, that's a really good point, because, and I'll get to you, Eddie, I saw your finger go up there. I think a lot of times intervention by a veterinary behaviorist as a beginning point can be very, 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 very helpful. Eddie, what were you going to add?
So I'm going to avoid saying anything overly academic about this topic in general, because I don't think that's very helpful. But I did want to say, I think what Beth and others have said about connecting with the client, showing that you are acknowledging their experience, that is pretty important. That's something that my experience with this is in talking to students and getting them to understand in many cases how they can talk about and think about and assess and improve behavior, assess and manage behavior. Since I spend a lot of time talking to students about that, what they do to do that. And that's critical. Everyone, as what's already been said here by others, people want to from the start be acknowledged, right? So that's going to be important. And then I think Sam put this really simply, it's a great way to get the focus on what the animal is doing, is to ask, you know, from my more technical standpoint, I'd say, how do you operationalize that, right? But that's what we're doing in a simple way when we just say, what does that look like to you? Yep. So tell me what that looks like. And the reason why that's so important is because it's giving you a language that you can share with that person to talk about something that's now reliable, right? You're putting the focus on what the animal is doing and in a way that both of you can observe it directly. And that's one of the most important applications, I think, of taking a behavioral understanding of what's happening, is to get some ability to communicate about even what the problem is. So doing it as simply as that, as the way Sam put it, what does that look like to you? Perfect. That's great.
What are some of the... Go ahead, Beth.
I was going to say, you know, following up on what Eduardo said, I find once I have a client, they actually get excited when I start talking to them about, you know, let's keep track of, like, what time of day does this seem to occur? Is there a room in the house where it seems to happen? Does it happen more with mom than with dad? You know, what are the, you know, and then they get excited. And I actually say, let's get some data and do it like real scientists. And they get excited about that. They actually do. When I use the word data, they're like, oh, we could do data. We, you know, we could be real scientists. And then, like, when we talk a week later, they're like, so it happened at 4:02 on Wednesday. They're actually really getting into it, and they get excited about doing it in that way.
Oh, I love that, and I love data, which is going to kind of lead into my next question. Sometimes when we're working with these clients, we're asking them to change their behavior in order to change the animal's behavior, or do things like simple management things, which can often solve the behavior immediately, or collect data, which they are very, very hesitant to do. How do you convince them and change their minds that some of these things are worth doing and are really going to be necessary for you to help them? Judy.
It really all depends on how you relay that information to them. I do the same thing that Beth does. And for instance, if I had an aggressive dog case and the dog is biting someone in the family, I tell them, I want you to write everything down and take a photo if you want. I want to know if the lamp's on. I want to know if it's raining outside. When was the last time the dog ate? I want to know the temperature outside. I want to know every single thing. Is the dryer on with dryer sheets in it? Or a candle being lit? And you know, it's so quick to change what's going on with the dog when people understand the world is important to that dog. And with teaching them how to observe the environment, you're stopping future problems from occurring. Because now they're jumping in and they're like, you know what? The dog's kind of crabby today. Oh my gosh, it's raining. And the refrigerator's making a big noise. And they start putting that together in their own head. And you know what? It allows me to go see another client because now they can fix their own problems. And it's all in how we present it.
And I think that makes a difference. And I think when we present it, one of the things I have been doing with my puppy students for the past 4+ years now is when you're talking with puppy students, house training is a topic, right? You mean that's just something you have to talk about. And, you know, so we go through all of the steps and a recommended protocol and stuff. And then I explain that, you know, when I got Muppy, she was a rescue dog. The shelter, the rescue said, oh, they're house trained. They almost always tell you that. And I've learned from experience that often they're not. So what did I do? I put my engineer hat on and I started collecting data from day one that I would ask anyone with a house training issue. And I describe that and why it's valuable. And I tell them, you know, if you don't follow my protocol and you have house training issues still, give me a call. But the first thing I'm going to ask for is data. And by the end of that, I think I have most of them convinced that, oh, I get exactly why you want to know those things, because those all affect house training. Judy.
I'm also going to say that for house training, for instance, I make cute little charts up. They can put them on the fridge. They can do whatever they want. But it's really easy to put a check mark next to the poop emoji or a check mark underneath the water droplet. And then I have a little map and they just have to write down location. And I do have to work for them. They just have to fill in the blanks. And I make it fun because I do, you know, cute little graphics that they think is entertaining. I think sometimes they want the dog to go potty so they can go put a check somewhere.
House training bingo. I love it.
Yeah, just like that. But we can do that for other things, right? We can do that for anything that's going on. And if it's hard for people to visualize what data is. And if we can do that first step for them, oftentimes it happens easier for them.
And oftentimes we have to teach them what we want them to look for. I mean, this is, mm-hmm. we've talked about this before, whether it's dogs or cats, body language is incredibly important. Most of my clients anyway, maybe you're luckier, but have had no background in what to even look for. So we've got to teach them that before they even know what to look for. Allison, you had your hand up.
I was just going to say with data, first, Judy, the way you prepare stuff for your clients is so much more fun and better than I do. I start them off with a spreadsheet, but at least I do start them with something, but I like your idea. But the thing that I'll tell my clients is, I said, there's always a reason for what's happening. So if we can get some data, we can get some patterns, we can see a consistency somewhere here. And then once we see that pattern, then that's going to tell us, okay, what kind of solution are we going to have? And so I guide them through that process, and people usually buy into it. And I guess the other thing I would say is, a lot of my clients come to me pretty, I don't know why, pretty cat savvy, which means I usually have to kind of keep one step ahead of them because I always view it as like, I always tell them we're kind of like it's a cooperative thing because they bring so much, I bring stuff, I'm just kind of adding some stuff to what they already know, and we're just going to keep, they'll add and I'll add, and we just, so that's how it goes.
Sam?
The one thing I found with, and again, the cases that I work with, is I have, when I'm asking for information or data, I've got to do it in small batches. Because for a lot of people, it's like going down a rabbit hole, and then they get overwhelmed and then they won't do it at all. Right. So I know from my bite cases, you know, we start off with maybe four or five things. Okay. And once we get an idea on that, and then I'll say, okay, well, now what about these, you know, four or five things? And then I have them review all of it with me so we can find common denominators, et cetera. But also depends on, and I'm finding this with my demographic, because for a lot of my much older clients, that's way beyond where something they want to handle. And then I have two clients of mine who are very high up in the Google organization. And with them, it's like, oh, you want data? You want data? Let me give you data, you know? And the next thing, there's 85,000 spreadsheets coming through, you know? But it's one of the things we have to take into consideration is the client that we're dealing with. For a lot of people, yes, they're trying to find a quick solution because they're scared and whatever is happening. We just got to be careful on how we're asking them to do stuff. We got to parse it out so that they don't get overwhelmed, because once we get overwhelmed, like anything else in life, we have a tendency to say, screw it, you know, we're just not going to do it.
To venture into using some behavior technology or jargon, we need to shape them. Rather than just throw it all at them. Christina.
I was just going to say, we can also take data. And I think that in addition to tracking, you know, having the client track and figuring out patterns, it can be really helpful for helping the client see that progress has actually happened or identifying that it hasn't. Because if you have a behavior that's happening very frequently, it can be difficult to tell when things have gotten better unless you're actually tracking it. But I will sometimes, if I'm having trouble getting the client to take their own data, I can always take data when I'm there and then relay that to them. So I do a lot of work on getting dogs to disengage from the environment. So working with fearful dogs or dogs that are having strong reactions to a variety of stimuli. And one of the easiest things to track is how long does it take them when we go to a new area, or even when we go to an area that we've been before, how long does it take them to disengage and to be able to kind of relax and focus on me or start sniffing around? And that's a super easy thing for me to do because I'm standing there working on it anyway. And then we can share that with them, and that can help them see progress and maybe see some of the benefits of tracking some of these things.
Well, that's one way I sell data collection too, is by doing this and you see improvement, that's right. Positive reinforcement to them. And that is very, very helpful. Sometimes the biggest thing is getting them to see something, you know, they see two things, problem and problem solved, which again, we kind of have to get into this incremental approach that, you know, this little bit, okay, it was 2 seconds longer before you started reacting. That's huge. It's happening consistently. They don't necessarily see that. We have to help them see that. Other thoughts right now? Or do I need to take us down a bunny trail? That should frighten all of you. Allison.
Well, I can just jump onto what Christina said of, and even though I do try to get my clients to collect data, I have had times when I'll do it. And I actually had one with a recent case where the cats needed to be on medication in my mind, but the client did not think that. And I looked back through all of the notes that we had and all the data we had taken, and I created a spreadsheet of when the cats were doing well and when they weren't. And I showed it to him and I said, okay, so when the cats weren't on the medication, this is all the behaviors you were seeing you didn't want. When they're on the medication, these are all the cool things that were happening. So I think that means, you know, I know it's hard to tell if there's improvement when there's medication, especially when you're kind of looking back and it goes on for a long time and maybe only little things, but the data is showing us that these cats are doing so well on the medication. So I want you to make sure that you are staying in touch with your vet and keeping the cats on medication as long as your vet says that. So that was a case where I took the data and it was, that was what helped those cats as far as what they needed for their.
Excellent. And then you gave me another segue here. So none of us are veterinarians here, right? If you're a veterinarian, raise your hand. Okay. So we can't prescribe medications, but I'm betting we have all had cases where at first glance, we're thinking, boy, this person really needs to talk to a vet behaviorist. And you have a client like Allison's who really is hesitant about medication. How do you sell that? Dan and then Beth.
Yeah, I like to tell stories about my own experience with my dogs. And Buddha had separation anxiety when we adopted him. And he would go into a state of panic within 5 seconds, and digging up the linoleum and crying, and just he couldn't cope with being left alone. And he was already on anti-anxiety medication when we adopted him. So I talked about the data keeping process we went through to keep a record of improvement, which probably took about 10 weeks. I said, if I didn't have that, I would have been frustrated and thought, oh, he's still going into a panic. But so I was pointing out that incremental process of improvement, but I'm also quite sure he wouldn't have made any progress without medication. And as we saw the progress, and he was tolerating being on his own for up to 45 minutes, we began weaning him off the medication as the veterinarian advised, and found he was fine without it for the next 10, 11 years. And then I compared that to our other dog that we adopted. Gandhi had separation anxiety as well, but the onset was not 5 seconds. It was more like 6.5 minutes. And then he started getting into a panicky mode. And we didn't need medication with him. It wasn't as severe, but it also took just as long. So I think it helps to talk about our own experiences so that people know we have empathy with their situation. And, for some dogs, medication is the key to making progress beyond a certain point.
Beth, you had wanted to make a comment on that as well.
Yeah, and it's just because I have a client who I've just started with. We've had this very issue. So very often I'm suggesting medication with aggression issues. And she contacted me with a cat who is aggressing, and she's for now unable to identify the triggers. And so I talked to her about speaking to her vet about medication. The problem with veterinary behaviorists in the New York City area is that there's currently only one practice. You typically have to wait 4 to 5 to 6 months to get an appointment with them. And if you have a cat who's aggressing and you can't identify the triggers, you can't wait 6 months to get the cat medicated. And often what they charge, which I think is not unfair what they charge, but it's often beyond the means of the clients that I see. So what I have done with this particular client is encourage her to speak to her own veterinarian about medication. And so the first thing we did when she contacted me was, and we had a long talk about the problem, I said, before we can begin behavior work, I think your cat needs to be medicated, and I'm going to explain why. And what I explained was that I felt that her cat's baseline level of arousal was so high that the cat, you know, it was very quick for the cat to then proceed to aggressive behavior, that the cat's baseline arousal level is very high. And I explained that that's difficult to address with purely behavioral solutions, that there's biology involved in that, and that medication is going to help with that. But whenever I talk about medication, I always add the caveat that because I am not a DVM, there is a limit to what I can tell them about medication, and that that I'm going to respect that limit. I explain that I can't, for instance, say you should medicate your cat, or you must medicate your cat, or here's the medication you should give your cat, or the dosage or the length. And I explain that all of that would be illegal for me to discuss with them. That what we are discussing is that I'm suggesting that they have a conversation with their veterinarian, and that if their veterinarian feels it's appropriate, the cat should be medicated. And then I give them some talking points for their veterinarian, which is basically to explain what the problem is, to explain how often it occurs, and to explain that they can identify the trigger. And if they would like, also to say that they've been in touch with a behaviorist, and the behaviorist suggested that they have this conversation with their veterinarian. So that's kind of what I do.
So looking at the time, I've got one last question for us. We can take on a client, we can make progress, but sometimes that progress stops before you get to the point where you need to get, or sometimes after working with them for a while, you see you're not making any progress at all for a variety of reasons. What do you do?
I feel like for me, it's the same answer. Veterinary behaviorist. I mean, that would be, that would often be what I would turn to if we hadn't already gone down that route. And if I'm totally out of ideas, then probably the first thing that I would do is reach out to colleagues and ask for feedback. I did that on a cat dog case because I'm not as familiar with cats. And actually the cats were fine. It was the dog that was the issue, but he wasn't making progress. And so I reached out to a colleague, and I actually hired her to sit in on our consults so that then I got to learn too. So instead of just referring, I got to learn more. So that's what I would do. One of the things I would do.
Okay. Good thought. Anyone else have anything they want to add on that?
That's been good.
Dan.
Yeah, I'll jump into that. I keep a referral list of local forestry behavior consultants. We don't have any veterinary behaviorists in Wisconsin that I'm aware of. And I don't even know of any practicing certified applied animal behaviorists. So it's either I can refer them to someone that has more experience than I do, or is more capable. I'm not afraid of referring to others if I think I'm not the one to help the person. And there are always veterinary behaviorists that I've met who are willing to consult for no fee with the local family vet to give them their expert advice rather than hear it through a trainer or a behavior consultant. So there is help available. And there are certainly people that know a lot more about particular behavior problems than I do. So I'd like to feed people information if we reach a point where I think I'm not able to help.
Excellent advice. Thank you, everyone, for a excellent panel today. I really appreciate it. So June's topic, which will be on Wednesday, June 19th at noon. And it's kind of a long topic, but it is the importance of empathy and compassion in animal training, why there is no need for violence ever. We're going to use this as a relaunch of the Shock Free Coalition, now with the new website running smoothly. And we're going to be talking not just about shock collars, but we're going to be talking about punishment in general, prong collars, choke collars. I've already got a start of an outline, I think some of that's been sent to some of you already. If not, we will be getting that to you definitely well in advance. So that is a good topic as well. But thank you so much for being here, panel, and listeners, thank you for being here today as well. And we hope you will join us on June 19th.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.